from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. I'm your host, Jay Moran, today with us a repeat guest. We've had Ben Hillegas here a couple of times before, the executive director of the Buffalo Educational Opportunity Center here in Buffalo. Ben, good to have you back.
Jay, good morning. It's so great to be back. Thank you for having me.
You've been busy since you took over this position back in 2023, or getting close to 3 full years there at
Correct.
The Educational Opportunity Center. The one thing you wanted to mention, this is interesting, 60 years since this began.
That's right. We're really excited this year as a system across New York State. There are 10 other EOCs across New York State and all of the upstate cities and all of the boroughs, as well as Long Island and Westchester. And this system grew over the last six decades. In 1966, Mr. Arthur O'Eve, legendary Buffalo figure, spearheaded legislation that created the EOC system. And it was a small system at that time. It was Buffalo, Albany, Manhattan, and Brooklyn, the four original centers. And over the last 6 years, it's grown and evolved to be this comprehensive opportunity program that offers, thousands of chances for people to improve their situations across New York State. So as a system, we're celebrating that this year. We're really excited about it. We're going to do collaborative events between centers across the state, and each individual center is going to be celebrating this year. So we'll be really leaning into it at our commencement ceremony in May. We're going to have some special guests, we hope, that'll really help tie the history of the EOC to the current times. And I think it's also really, it's important to remember and note, especially as we're entering into Black History Month, that, this legislation passing in 1966 was right in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. And this legislation was a result of and part of the Civil Rights Movement. And it's really a part of history that still exists today. And we're still have the same mission of trying to create more equity in the economic and academic settings for people in Buffalo.
And while, of course, there's been an evolution of the Educational Opportunity Center throughout the years, the mission, how do you describe the mission?
The mission, honestly, it's a little unfortunate. It hasn't changed because circumstances, unfortunately, haven't changed that much, right? I think Mr. Eve created the system. He had a vision where he wanted to be able to create a level playing field, or more level playing field for folks, recognizing that many people in Buffalo and across the state, primarily people of color, did not have the same opportunities as their peers in other demographics. And if you don't have the resources and you don't have the same level of familiar support or social support, you don't have access to the same opportunities. So that's why free educational and vocational training program was the part of his vision and the answer and the solution that he created. So, we want to give people a chance that they didn't have previously in order to get to a point where they can start to really have economic mobility and build a better life and, have it be generational, have, an impact where the children of folks that we serve are then in a better position to have more opportunity as they grow up. And it's the same today as it was 60 years ago, honestly.
We could probably have more than one program, several programs, just talking about some of the different success stories that are coming out of the EOC. But just a moment before we hopped on the air here, you told me that you outlined it. You had at least one person, you told me, that was incarcerated and went through your program and found their way into the trades, and now among the many who are out working lots of overtime, I'm pretty sure, out of the new Buffalo Bills Stadium. Let's just talk, give me as much as you can about that story and others.
Yeah, it is not unique. However, it is an incredible story.
Absolutely.
So we talk about this particular individual pretty frequently. Charles from UB Communications is familiar with him. We've done some stories. And again, I just want to emphasize, it's not really unique, but it's really special. So that's
absolutely
why we talk about this particular individual. But a gentleman, when he came to us, 41 years old, had been incarcerated New York State prison for 17 years at that time, was recently out, young daughter, girlfriend, really trying to establish, you know, some stability in his life and just have a life that he hadn't had the opportunity to have for a considerable amount of time. And somehow he, you know, through our outreach efforts and our recruitment, he learned about our pre-apprenticeship skilled trades program, and with no, very little information, just kind of showed up. It is Buffalo. It's a small community. So he had, turns out he had some familiarity with our director of enrollment management from growing up. Like, they had a connection. So there was some trust that was established at that point, which is, you know, always really important. And I don't think he knew what he was getting into. I can't recall exactly, but he might have been part of our first cohort. So it was a brand new program for us that we were standing up, you know, from the ground up, just completely developed from scratch. So, you know, he was taking as much of a chance on us as we were taking a chance on him. And he got into the program. And I think he just, like so many of our students, he pretty quickly identified the opportunity that was in front of him, like, wow, this is a real thing, and this might actually be my ticket. So he committed to the program. It's only 7.5 weeks. In that program, we have a very specific curriculum that was developed by the National Building Trades Association specifically to prepare people to be apprentices with skilled trade unions. So it was developed by unions for unions. And it doesn't teach you how to be a welder, doesn't teach you how to be a pipe fitter or a laborer, but it teaches you how to be an apprentice. It teaches you how to be prepared to take advantage of the opportunity to be an apprentice, get the hard skills, and then become a, you know, bona fide union journey person. So he fully embraced the program. He got all the certificates. He got all the credentials. In that program, we have very intentional relationships with the unions. So we basically are able to have a smooth handoff. The students still have to qualify. They still have to, you know, interview. They got to do all the normal steps to get into an apprenticeship. But they're coming from us, so they have credibility. They've got the credentials, so they have credibility. And they generally have an advantage when they go to get into the union. And we've been very successful. Our first year, which was 2024-25, we've had 70% of our students actually become union apprentices, which is
70%.
It's an incredibly high success rate. We're extremely proud of it. And I could go on.
It reflects a couple of things, right? It reflects the need that, and we've had stories on for years about the need in local trades. So now this program is helping to fill that, but also the idea that, you know, whatever an individual went through in their life and whatever, you know, roads they went on that didn't lead them to success, and in this particular case, incarceration, that there are opportunities. I think maybe you feel this way, but I'll let you clarify for yourself. The idea that there are opportunities for everybody, it's sometimes just matching the 100%. Skills, the talents with those opportunities.
I'd like to come back to the story, but you're absolutely describing exactly what I think, what the EOC is. There is no limit to the amount of chances that a person might need in order to be successful. You know what I mean? And eventually it sticks. People may fail repeatedly, often not for, you know, for reasons that are beyond their control. And the amount of resilience it takes to keep getting up and trying again and come through the door. You can come to the EOC a half a dozen times and try a GED program. Keep coming. If it doesn't work for whatever reason, keep coming. The seventh time it might stick.
Right.
It's just the resilience that our students demonstrate is incredible. But we are there. We are always there. There's no limit to the amount of chances, I think, because you just never know when the circumstances are going to align and the timing's going to work out and you're going to be successful. So just coming back to that individual real quick, we expose them to all sorts of trades. We have these relationships. We bring the students to the training halls of a handful of unions, and then they get hands-on experience. They get to learn really what this specific trade is about. He identified the Smart 71, which is primarily sheet metal. So they do all the HVAC duct work, that type of stuff, but they weld. So they have a lot of work on the stadium. And he was admitted to that union almost within a few weeks, started working on the stadium up on high lifts, you know, hanging hundreds of feet in the air, welding over his head.
Right.
And they love him there. He's a leader in his apprenticeship group. And every student that we place with the unions, and I knew this was our responsibility, was to make sure that we were sending really prepared students, because we also need the credibility that we establish by sending the students, so that the unions know that, okay, this is legit. This is a real program. These people are highly qualified. They care. And it just reinforces the success, right? Because they know they can trust us, and they know we're going to send them great people, which means they take more people, which means we provide more opportunity. And so far that cycle has really been self-fulfilling, and it's very gratifying for all of us, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about stories like that, I feel like I could probably listen to it all the time. I mean, it just really connects that concept of hope with reality.
100%.
And then we can have positive realities in this world.
Let me just add real quick, that specific program at DOC is state funded. We're part of SUNY. We're part of the University of Buffalo. We get all of our funding directly from New York State. We're a state operated facility. But that program is supported by additional funding that we got from New York State Empire State Development Office of Strategic Workforce Development. And it was partially their idea. They really wanted to provide more access to underserved communities and increase capacity in the trades and help the unions fill the open roles that they had. And they've been tremendously supportive. We wouldn't be able to do it without them. And we're really grateful for the opportunity. And we're hoping that we're going to be able to expand now also a couple of different ways. Number one, just increasing the capacity of our cohorts. We're serving about, each class is about 16, 17 people right now. We want to get up maybe 20, 21, maybe even start two cohorts simultaneously to be able to serve more people. And we've started having some recent conversations about expanding geographically as well to some surrounding communities, potentially the city of Niagara Falls. That's in its initial phases. It's preliminary, but...
So transportation's
It's a barrier.
I guess it would
always
stand to reason, but it is it's
always
an issue.
A barrier, especially in the trades. And I know our time is limited, so I don't want to talk only
That's
about
right.
this program, but transportation is always a barrier for our students. Trades, it's even more pronounced because it's not point A to point B every day.
Right.
The jobs are everywhere. The jobs are in Orchard Park. The jobs are in Lewiston. The jobs are all over. They're in Batavia. And it you have to potentially get to a different job site in a different region of Western New York every single day. We have a relationship with West Her, and we have a couple of students who have worked with West Her, gotten some one-on-one attention, got a little bit of credit flexibility. We've worked with our students on financial literacy, and we've gotten a few students behind the wheel of new cars in our partnership with West Her, which is really, unfortunately, the only solution to the transportation problem generally, but specifically with the trades, because there's no public transportation option that's going to get you to a job site in Batavia. So recognizing that's a barrier, we've been really working hard to try to find solutions and getting our students, in some cases like 21, 22-year-old young people, behind the wheel of their first car that's affordable, that's reliable, that's going to get them to their job, which is now a career that's going to, you know, earn them, you know, six figures in not too long. It's amazing.
Well, as a son of a person who was in the trades for almost 50 years, I know I can say off the top of my head, I can say my father worked at just about every place in downtown Buffalo, West Valley. He worked in Pittsburgh, and those are just on the top of it. So mobility is important, that's for sure. We're talking this morning with Ben Hilgus, from the executive director from the Buffalo Educational Opportunity Center. Let's just take one quick moment for outreach, and we can obviously get back to this. But if somebody is hearing about what you're talking about, and we actually have only kind of focused on one element of it, what's the best way to go?
Yes. So our website is the best way to reach us.
Okay.
We have kind of a main front door, single point of access, which is our application. You can call anytime, but if you just Google Buffalo EOC, you'll find us. Also, the website is www.buffalo.edu/EOC. Very easy way to find us. You'll find information on all of our programs. Pretty easy to navigate website. That application, it's the front door. Once you fill that out, you're going to hear from us, and we're not going to let you go until we determine exactly what it is that you need. So I just, because we're not, we have programs that are outside of our doors too. We have a GED program at Northland. We have a new program serving youth in the North Towns in Lancaster. And just making sure that people understand that the application is like, that's the best place to start.
Sure.
If you fill that out, if we get your contact information, then someone from our admissions team is going to be calling you within 24 hours and figuring out how we can help.
And as a son of a person who was in the trades and found out the hard way that he could not follow his father's footsteps, you have other programs other than the trades, of
yes.
course, and that are actually almost kind of like the staples, for lack of a better term, of the Educational Opportunity Center.
Yeah, we're really glad that we're in the trades now. It was one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish when I came in. For a while, been known primarily for our allied health programs,
right.
Which we're very proud of also, and that we've been able to expand recently. But traditionally, more attractive to women, more women filling those roles. So our student population demographics, we're skewing pretty heavily female, which is fine, again, but we want to be able to provide opportunities for men as well. So we got into the trades. We've also really been able to expand our commercial driver's license program and enhance that recently. We have men in the allied health programs, and we have women in both trades and CDL. But again, generally speaking,
right.
they lean one way or the other. Our CDL program, we just enrolled 17 students this January, which prior to that we were seeing five or six. We really wanted to emphasize it. And one of the things that we're most excited about is we now have a partnership with Stevens Driving School. So our part of the program is classroom-based. It's theoretical. It gives the students everything that they need to know in order to get their CDL permit. They go down, they get their CDL permit. We pay for the application fee. We do all of that. Once they get their permit, they come back to us. We have a state-of-the-art CDL driving simulator, which is this enormous contraption. It would fill up half of this room. Three immersive giant LCD screens. It's got the double clutch. It's got the seat. The seat rumbles. It's a very expensive video game, but it gives you a lot of really, really significant behind the wheel training without actually being behind the wheel. So we put them through a 2-week simulation course, and then we send them to Stevens, where they get the hours that they need behind the wheel. And then Stevens takes them to their driving test and gets them their CDL. So from start to finish, we're recruiting people off the street with limited experience. And then once they have a commercial driver's license, I mean, that is the ultimate credential that, again, unlocks an entire career. And there's such high demand in that industry that folks get a job almost immediately, starting, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, and then the sky's the limit from there. So we're very proud of that program also.
So I think I heard you use the term recruited these people. I mean, what is the pathway that you find? Probably there's no real one typical pathway for people who end up going through the Education Opportunity
It's a great
Center.
Question. I mean, we there are so many different people who come to the EOC. Like people ask, are you mostly young people, older people?
Right.
And just because of the varied nature of our programs and the extensive nature of our outreach, there's just, we have a very robust ESL program. So we have people from all over the world walking around the building at any given time. And then, we have done some specific targeted outreach recently for kind of the out of school youth population, kids, young people who have dropped out of school formally, but are still under the age of 21 or 24, who are trying to pursue their GED. We're bringing them in to help them with their GED, with the ESL, and then also to direct them once they get those credentials, direct them to some of our programs, which we're excited about. And then, we have people in their 60s, 70s who are in the building doing academic review, maybe also learning English, maybe still getting their GED, pursuing some of our vocational programs. So back to the outreach and the recruitment, there's a couple of things. 60 years is a long time, right? So the EOC has been in this community for that period of time. We have served, multiple generations of the same families. We actually have someone who works in our admissions office who is a former graduate. Her mother is a former graduate, and her daughter just received her GED and will be walking across the stage at commencement in May this year, which is not unique. So there's a lot of word of mouth, right?
Okay.
An unusual, I think, but not unique to Buffalo circumstance is that, and you, I think you have experienced this, not a ton of people are familiar with the OC.
Right.
It's just not incredibly well known. And that's the case in many centers in other parts of the state, including, you know, including in the city. The center in Manhattan is in Harlem on 125th and Lenox. It's right there. It's been there forever. And yet, if you walked around the neighborhood, some people might not even know it was there, which is, it's kind of unique and uncommon. So why is that? And we have a leader, the person who runs the system in Albany, and she likes to say that it's, if not knowing about the EOC is a luxury. If you need to know about the EOC, you know about the EOC. And
right.
If you've never heard of the EOC, it's because you're not in a circumstance where you need to, and that's a privilege, not knowing about the EOC. But a lot of people do know about the EOC. So there is the word of mouth kind of dynamic that brings people to us. But then we have a really strong admissions and recruitment team that I'm really proud of. It's one of our greatest assets, I think. And they're just out in the community all the time. Anytime there's any kind of resource fairs or something happening in a community center or a library or a church or any place where people gather anywhere in Buffalo, our team is generally out there providing information, meeting people where they're at, and just all we can do is tell them about the opportunities that we have and be able to, you know, this is what it is and this is what it leads to and this is, you know, what you can expect. And then, you know, people make their own decisions, but for the most part, our applications, have just been going up and up and up over the last couple of years. There's a lot of interest, and all of those applications don't necessarily, result in students sitting in seats. It's
sure.
The funnel gets pretty narrow pretty quickly. But just the fact that there is the interest and that, you know, if you fill out an application and you don't end up coming in and talking to somebody, or you don't provide the documentation, or you, for whatever reason, you don't end up in the seat. We know that you at one point were thinking about it, and we hope that, you know, when the circumstances allow, you try again. But it's I'd say our admissions team, you know, it's challenging work because they do have to convert that interest into actual action, which is
right.
Not an easy thing to do. But at the same time, you know, we have momentum and, people want to take advantage of the opportunities we have. So, you know, their job could be harder, I guess I'm trying to say.
As I consider this in real time, I'm reflecting back to when we first chatted a couple of years ago, and I'm pretty sure that was right around the time that you took this position or not too long after. And I'm just wondering for you, and I kind of sense it just by our conversation and how you look as you're answering, but where you stand, what you have come to understand, and what you want other people to understand about connecting opportunities, a place like the Educational Opportunity Center, with a part of our population that is often overlooked and forgotten, and in some cases, vilified. How do you put that all together? Where do you stand?
Well, I mean, I stand with those people, Jay. That's where I've always stood throughout my career. I just really appreciate the opportunity to, you know, help, support, just be, I'm just a guy. I'm in a position where resources are available because of something that a tremendous leader in our community accomplished 60 years ago, right? And that for the last 60 years, it's the legislature, the assembly, that has continued to support the EOC and the EOC system across the state. It's not like an afterthought for them. It really is not. And I've spoken to many of them, especially our folks here in Buffalo, our wonderful majority leader, Crystal Peebles Stokes, who's a very strong advocate of our programs. They do it because they care. They do it because they're connected to the EOCs. They do it because they're connected to their constituents who they know need the services of the EOC, who they know are often overlooked and not considered. And as you said, in some cases vilified and neglected. And so they consistently support our programs because in the absence of the EOC, we're not solving everybody's problems, but what would people do in the absence of the EOC? It's that important. Like if we can get just a handful, and that's not our goal, and we far exceed it, but if we can get just a handful of families to a more economically stable situation, and get people credentials that are tangible and can't be taken away from them, and qualify them for jobs that have advancement opportunities and really provide the opportunity for economic mobility. Like, that's transformative. That's a game changer. And not just for those individuals, it is for the whole community. And, you know, the challenges are immense, right? Like the level of poverty and lack of opportunity in our city is extremely high. And we can only chip away at it through what we do, but we want to chip more and more and more and really, you know, just absolutely maximize those resources that we have that those leaders so graciously and intentionally provide to make sure that we're having the impact that we're supposed to have. I hope that answers the question.
It answered the question with lots of passion and and power for sure. So, and it'd be a great way to leave it, but we also want to, again, just repeat because we had it in the middle of the program as well. Best way for somebody who should be reaching out to the Educational Opportunity Center and how can they do
it? Great question, Jay. So who, I mean, anybody who feels like, A, we do have some eligibility criteria, and just to be specific, 250%, below 250% of the poverty level, which is relatively high, less than 33 college credits. So this is satisfying the two criteria, which is economically disadvantaged and educationally disadvantaged. So you can't have more than 33 college credits. And you have to be a New York State resident. That's it. So lots of people are eligible. And if you meet that eligibility and you are interested in a career in the trades or a career in allied health, or you didn't get your high school diploma and you feel like it's been holding you back, or you know your English is a little limited or extremely limited and you feel like that's holding you back, and you're just looking for opportunities to advance, and you know, beyond just the specific programs, looking for people who want to help and who care and who will, you know, wrap around you and pour into you, you should consider the EOC. And, you know, it's nothing but one step, right? So take the first step, fill out the application, make the phone call, come into the building. If it doesn't feel like it's right for you, then, you know, no application.
Right.
You turn around and walk out and you've learned something, right? You've had an experience that maybe, you know, down the line, a few weeks, months, years, you're like, you know what? I kind of think maybe I'm ready to take that step. We're there for you. And that's what I would most like to convey, is that it is an open door. We are funded in order to serve the public specifically. We're not funded, you know, so I can have a job, so I can sit here and talk to you, so the teachers or the counselors have jobs. We're funded to serve the public, to serve the people, to have them come in, take advantage of our beautiful space and the education and opportunities that we have. So just, I want people to know it's a building for the people. It's for a building for the people that we've been talking about. And give us a call, fill out the application. Again, the website is the best entry point because you can learn a lot about it. And www.buffalo.edu/EOC. Take a look, call the number, fill out the application, and we can't wait to meet you.
Ben Hillegas, is always a pleasure having you with us on What's Next.
Thank you so much, Jay. Real privilege.
Ben Hillegas, Executive Director of the Buffalo Educational Opportunity Center, with us on What's Next. Up next, Akua Menzedu talks with Cyntia Taylor of Buffalo Black Nurses. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media brings our community together with programs that inspire, inform, and entertain. Enjoy trusted news, local performances, educational resources, and cultural treasures all in one place. It's more than media. It's a connection to the world around you. Discover what Buffalo Toronto Public Media offers at btpm.org. This is Public Media.
From Morning Edition to Marketplace, Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, brings you news you can rely on. Local, national, and global. Stay informed with BTPM NPR and take it with you on the BTPM Listen app.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media. I am your host, Akua Menzedu. If you've ever interacted with the healthcare system in the last few years as a patient, a caregiver, or a provider, you've likely felt how much strain it's under. And at the center of that strain are nurses. My guest today is Cyntia Taylor. who is a dual certified nurse practitioner in adult and acute critical care. She's also a mentor, a community leader, and an active member of organizations like Buffalo Black Nurses, working not just at the bedside, but to shape the future of the profession itself. This month, she's also serving as a panelist at Buffalo's Sankofa Conference, which brings together community leaders to reflect on the past and reimagine what's possible moving forward. So welcome to the show, Santaya.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And so before we get into your work, I want to start with you. What drew you into nursing and specifically into adult and critical care?
To try to summarize this as easy as possible, because I want to say I was always drawn to healthcare, but probably didn't know exactly where I wanted to be. I think as kids, we're always like drawn towards like being a doctor. So that was always like number one. We don't talk about all the other roles that are available in healthcare. But as I started to kind of transition through life, I had the elders in my family and in the community start to become more like ill and sick, and going to appointments with family members. And it's like, I really didn't even know what I was doing. And trying to be a biology major at UB and going towards the pre-med route, I felt like I was more withdrawn from the bedside. So at that moment, I took some time to reflect on what I wanted to actually do. And I realized that as nurses, they got the opportunity to actually be at the bedside with their patients, know their patients, have more of like a personal relationship with them, at the same time still understanding all the medical background and caring for them. And then I came to this realization that I didn't have to stop being a medical provider, that I can just keep going. And at that point, my end goal was always to become a nurse practitioner. How I ended up in adult was, I at first thought that maybe I wanted to do labor and delivery, but as I started to transition and do clinical work, I realized that that's not where my calling was at. It's nice, that's the happy place, bringing babies, everything else. But I think when I realized like helping my community, helping others, it was more of the adults, the elderly. Those are the ones that fall in more to sickness, that need our care, that need someone to be more of a liaison in the community to help them navigate their way. And at that moment, I just fell in love with critical care and fell in love with that fast pace, the very sick, that high energy. And as I started my career off as a float nurse at Sisters, as an RN, I ended up going to critical care. I was there for about like 6-7 years as a charge nurse, going to school for my bachelor's, my master's. And when I was done and had my nurse practitioner, I ended up at Mercy in the neurology department, and then later went back for my acute care certification and went to critical care. So that's where I'm at now.
That, first of all, that's an amazing, you know, career and journey.
Thank
it
you.
Sounds. That's a lot of work that it took to get there, right?
It was.
And so was there a moment when you knew this was more than a job for you?
Oh, yes. I want to say there was a time where I was actually working, and I see this patient all the time from there. So I think that's like my one like go-to moment I could think of. But I was working in a mother baby because I was afloat, and I would just go where the need was at. You showed up, you didn't know where you're going to be at that day. Your assignment was given to you where the need was at and where you were trained. And I was there, a mother baby with a mom who was pregnant with twins, and she ended up losing one. And she was there for like antepartum, where they have to stay the whole time for like the rest of their pregnancy. And at that point, she was still like preterm. So she was stuck in the hospital for weeks on end. And I became like really close with her in those couple of weeks, because she was already going through such a traumatic time in her life. And that sometimes you question like, what can I do for this person, or what am I doing? But just being there for her, like caring for her, you know, notifying the doctors of any change and so forth. She did go on to birth that healthy baby. And every time I see her in the community, we always catch up, and I have to see the pictures and everything. But it was like that moment where I still was like a brand new, like novice nurse, and I was unsure of myself. I think that solidified like, no, I'm right where I need to be at. And this is exactly what I want to do. I just had to find kind of where my niche was at. And I still didn't know at that moment.
I absolutely love that. And so you're dual certified,
yes.
Right? And
yes.
Deeply involved in mentoring others.
Yes.
So what do you think people often misunderstand about, you know, what nurses, especially nurse practitioners, actually do?
So I get this all the time, because I think a lot of times you know, when you say nurses, everyone just puts nurses in one category, like, oh, you're a nurse and that's it. I'm always going to be a nurse, first and foremost. You have to be a registered nurse to be a nurse practitioner. So I'm always a nurse at heart. I already have those skills at the bedside. That is what shaped and molded me for the background for everything that I kind of do in my career. But I think when it comes to nurse practitioners, a lot of time we are misrepresented, I think, by people, because when they go to their doctors, a lot of time, because of the shortage with medical providers, they don't even see their physician. A lot of times people go to a clinic and they don't even know who the actual attending or the physician that's over the whole clinic. They know their nurse practitioner. They know their PA, their physician assistant. That's who they know. Like, they follow them for years and they're always quick to say their name and never anyone else. And they're like, oh, my doctor. We're not an actual medical physician or a doctor of medicine. We are at least a master's prepared advanced nurse practitioner. And then some of us do go on to get our doctorates. I don't. I have a master's and I have a postmaster, but we treat, we diagnose, we do basically everything else that the doctor does. But I think that, and not saying thing, but I know that our way of caring still comes from that, like, nursing model. So a lot of times we're more personable, we're not dismissive. And a lot of, you know, patients will prefer to see their nurse practitioner than their doctors. And it's the same thing in the hospital where I'm at. You know, this doctor may walk in for a few minutes, assess them, see them, and go, okay, do you have any questions? Because basically I've done everything for the day.
Right.
You know, and I've already collaborated with them, and they're like, okay, good. And I'm the one that's taking care of them, really. You know, that I just go to my physician if there's any, you know, questions or concerns.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the lived reality of nursing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we often hear about burnout in healthcare and how difficult that is. But from your perspective on the ground, what is the reality for nursing right now?
I will say that burnout is real. As I'm looking, there's probably about 20 of us all together in this ICU. And that's like, it's hard to just say from a nursing perspective, because there's nurse practitioners and there's PAs, where what they kind of consider advanced practice practitioners or mid-levels. But through those nurses, if I had to kind of say, let's take like half of those, and those are nurses, the burnout can be real. The jobs can be very demanding. I don't think that not only do people understand that it is like long hours, long shifts. Sometimes you're taking a work home with you. You're finishing your admin. You're doing your charting. You're doing things like that. But then it's the emotional strain and the stress that I think people don't understand. Every day, you're not only trying to keep your own mental together, but you're dealing with patients and families when they're at their lowest, and people are coming to terms that they're end of life, or their family member or their loved one is at end of life. And you're also keeping it professional, giving them all the care that they need and all the answers, and you're working so hard on this patient, and sometimes you still come away with, no matter what you've done, that we still lose this patient. And that fast pace, that burnout, not having a lot of resources, not having the nursing staff underneath us to care for these patients, and then that even goes down to our CNAs and our assistants, that it kind of trickles all the way up the ladder, that we take on more responsibility. We're doing more. Not only are we doing all the prognosis, the testing, the treating, and then we're also at the bedside putting on bedpans on people and doing this and doing that. And after some time, it's not only taxing on the mind, because you're constantly thinking, you're like critically thinking, overanalyzing everything, but then at the same time, you're physically exhausted. Mm-hmm. You're at burnout. Mm-hmm. And I think that is recognizing it before you get there. And I think that's what a lot of nurses don't do. They work until they hit that burnout, till they hit that brick wall. And then there's like that love for nursing is gone, that compassion is gone, and we kind of forget the reason why we even got into nursing in the first place. Now we put our own mental health first, and a lot of people are switching from the bedside and they're leaving and they're going to other positions, like at insurance companies and kind of telemedicine, things like that, where they're kind of far and remove themselves from the bedside. And we are seeing it because we just keep losing nurses year after year.
Wow. Yeah. And I think, you know, and thinking about the last few years, even
COVID,
you know, we're seeing an increase in, you know, upper respiratory things that are happening. The flu that's been
horrible.
You know, really horrible.
It was horrible this season.
This season, right? Mm-hmm. And so how has the last few years really reshaped the profession, not just logistically, but emotionally? What doesn't show up in the headlines?
I want to say, if you know, we hear about the burnout, but I think that they don't actually look at the lack of nurses that we have. They're not looking at the numbers. Before 2020 happened, which is funny, we were all like in school and they had this like nursing model that was like about like nursing 2020. And it always talked about that there was going to be this mass shortage then. And we're like, why? Like, what's happening? Like, if you looked at the statistics, the schools were putting out so many nurses, nurse practitioners, everything that we're like, we don't see where it is coming from. I don't think anyone predicted that we're going to throw a pandemic in there and then that burnout happened and everybody like just left the bedside. So when we talk about that burnout, when we talk about that nursing shortage, there are some programs out there that are trying to still kind of just make the nursing field look enticing so that people will want to go into it. Like, hey, we have free tuition in some programs and everything else. But you will be surprised that the enrollment is still down, that these classes are not full to capacity, and also it's not for everyone. So even though you may start off with 100 nursing students, by the end, you're like probably only making or producing 40 of those nursing students at the end that actually go through with it and take their boards and are ready to work. So it's so discouraging. And then I think to tell us that, you know, our nursing provider as far as like nurse practitioners that we can't get the professional title anymore for reimbursement for our loans and tuition now is going to be even a more devastating shortage than there was before.
I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, obviously that's a new conversation that's happening in the current administration. And so talk a little bit about that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, these are things that we hear in the headlines, you know, now this isn't going to be recognized as a professional degree, what that means as it relates to tuition. So give us a little insight on that.
Yes, there is a certain cap that you are able to take as a grad student. And so there are levels when it comes to these degrees of grad students, and some of them are recognized as these professional degrees. That's like your nurse practitioner, your physician assistant, and there's some others, but just pertaining to this. But they allow you to take out more of, I want to say, tuition costs and loans and so forth. By removing that title of being a professional, now you're capping how much people can take out, or these students can take out, which they're now going to either be dependent or reliable of either A, their own savings and what they have, personal loans, and not everyone we know probably their credit or could afford to do that, or they're depending on if they have money saved or family paying for it. And a lot of students, I would say, as in my journey, they've all been dependent. I want to say majority of the class, we've all were dependent on taking out our loans ourselves. We did not have family paying our tuition. We didn't have savings up. We are usually someone that started off as the RN, and we said, you know what, we're going back to school. We worked our own way up. And that's like, I speak truth of that because I did it myself too. So without having the ability to take out those loans, to be able to go to school and fund my own education, I don't know that I will be sitting here. I really wouldn't be sitting here, to be totally honest.
We're talking about a shortage now.
A shortage.
Right? And
yes.
So something like this could potentially increase what that shortage
is going to, I believe, if we don't do something to change it, it's going to increase the shortage. And then we're going to be right back talking about burnout because you can't now expect the same few nurse practitioners or nurses now to take on more roles because they still have to be done, and breaking down that role of maybe just missing like two nurses, but that then role has to be absorbed into other nurses' daily functions.
Right.
And so you ask that one nurse now to, hey, can you do this now? Can you do that now? And eventually the burnout is going to be there. And that's what's happening.
Right. And honestly, you know, that difficulty, I think, will continue. Mm-hmm. We'll continue to see that. I want to shift a little bit and talk about race representation, and specifically, mm-hmm. you know, you're a part of Buffalo Black Nurses and other organizations. Yes. I know you mentioned Sigma Gamma Rho,
yes.
The mm-hmm. sorority. Mm-hmm. But why is representation in nursing and healthcare more broadly so critical?
I got to chill as soon as you said that, because I am the only nurse, black nurse practitioner, at my hospital. That's just it. It's me.
One. Wow.
We have a huge hospital system. And when you look around and, you know, I see other nurses, RNs, and we see all of our secretaries, our nursing assistants, dietary, environmental services, all of those. It's like they are so saturated with the African-American population, you know. Mm-hmm. But once you start kind of going up that corporate ladder and going into more of like the professionals and the med staff and looking at nurse practitioners, physician assistants, mm-hmm. Physicians, it's like you can basically count them all on one hand. So this kind of goes into this whole, I want to say, population almost in Buffalo, because I also work at another health system as well. And there, too, I'm like one of the only mm-hmm. Mid-levels that's African-American. But when you look around, the population that they're taking care of, the population that is critically ill, they're African-American. Now, a lot of times they don't even understand that our illnesses, our symptoms, the way we understand things, the way, because of our heritage and our roots, the way we treat things, the way we throw a little bit of our own, you know, non-medical, you know, care into it, is completely different from what they do in the hospital. And we don't have that representation. And a lot of times they're like, oh, they're just being non-compliant, like they're not doing what we tell them to do. But that's not true. Sometimes it's a lack of the education or resources. I remember my grandmother growing up, she would say, if you went to the hospital, you never left, you never went out. So she never followed with a doctor, never went to the hospital. And when she did finally go to the hospital, she died in the hospital, mm-hmm. just like she said. And the reason being is because of, we all know, we can bring it back to when they was experimenting and Tuskegee and everything else, what they've done to us. And there's such a lack for healthcare when it comes to Black people, and taking that time to just explain things to us because of our own misconceptions or our own fears that we have. I feel as though you need representation. It is so important, because a lot of times it's just a trust. Mm-hmm. Are you going to end up trusting, you know, someone of a different race that's just throwing a pill at you with no education and not telling you anything, or how this pill kind of affects an African-American is going to be completely different than how it's going to affect, you know, a white person? And having a Black person or anyone of color to be able to just take that time to hear them out, understand their fears and their needs, and is validated where they're coming from. And I think we understand that.
Right.
So we take that extra time to care and try to kind of confront all of those, what would I like to say, misconceptions mm-hmm. of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we're leaning on a community right now to kind of help us, put us out there in the community, let them know that, hey, there's Black nurses in every single field in the Buffalo area. We got a labor delivery, maternal, a mid-surg, cardiac, ICU. There is someone in every specialty that is African-American, or even our Hispanic population and things like that, where that you can go to and ask questions if you have a question or you need guidance on where to go or what to do. We just want to help our community be more educated, so that way they are more proactive with taking that lead to take care of themselves. So that way we're not catching things when it's too late.
Right.
And now when they're going to the hospital, they're not coming out because their disease now is far too gone.
Right. That's honestly really powerful. And it makes me think about what you said in terms of the education component and making sure that we're connecting to our larger community.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you're a part of Buffalo Black Nurses and
yes.
also Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority.
Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority, yep.
And you talked about like collaboration and the importance
yes.
of that. And so I want to kind of hear from you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what ways are you kind of collaborating within the organizations you're a part of, and what are you proud about?
Oh, I'm proud of so much. So you have to stop me here because I'm going to go on. But I would say I've always been passionate about mentoring not only new nurses or a nurse or someone in the community that wants to be a nurse or maybe want to be a nurse practitioner, but they don't know where to start. They don't know where to go. That's where Buffalo Black Nurses comes in at. And I mentor some of these newer nurses that just want to know, like, what's the first step if I want to, you know, have a career like yours, or I'm actually going into my nurse practitioner. What do I need to do? I need preceptors. I need things like that. And that's where we kind of help to collaborate with the community and mentor and so forth. I've always been passionate about that because I did not have a mentor. I literally had to figure this out on my own. And it was difficult. It was very hard. And I wish sometimes I had someone to ask a question to. There was many times I wanted to just give up and walk away. So that's why I do this, because I don't want to discourage someone else for coming into this profession, because we are reaching burnout and I need some help. So I would love for some more Black nurse practitioners to come into this profession. With Sigma Gamma Rho, we have a lot of like national programs, local programs. A lot of them actually do end up being the health and wellness portion of it, where I know we were founded by educators, but we do so much in our like maternal health and perinatal health, because we know that our African Americans have a higher outcome of death or mortality with pregnancy and around childcare. So if you have a lot of educators and people from different backgrounds that's in Sigma Gamma Rho, you always need a healthcare person as well too, right, to kind of be that person to help pave the way for those or collaborate or know, hey, I know a whole bunch of nurses here that will be more than happy to come and collaborate with you guys and speak on, you know, what we can do to help minimize these like mortality rates that we have with perinatal care. So I've actually now have both Buffalo Black Nurses and Sigma Gamma Rho and Buffalo Eta Rho Sigma collaborating, where we would now have nurses and our healthcare providers that will be right there to help and educate the community and do a lot of volunteer work with them, so that way we can kind of get rid of the stigmas and lower those mortality rates that's with, you know, mother baby and perinatal care.
I honestly love to hear that, the collaboration and coming together, because, you know, the need is so great. And so great. We need so many people to focus on these things. And so I want to talk a little bit about the conference. You are on the healthcare panel.
Yes.
And so what kind of conversations are you hoping that people walk away after going to this conference? The conference is Sankofa, which means to go back and fetch it. Right.
Yes.
And so what does that mean to you? And what do you hope people walk away with?
What it means to me is that I think when it comes to healthcare, my biggest thing is telling people is to advocate for yourself. Knowing when to speak up, knowing when to ask questions, knowing when something isn't right, knowing to go get a second opinion, and not be afraid to do that. I feel like a lot of times we end up at the doctor's office or in the hospital and they just tell us one thing and we just say, okay, and we go with it. And we still walk away with so many questions and uncertainty. Oh, the doctor just told me to take this pill twice a day. Why are you taking it? They have no idea why they're taking this pill. Oh, it makes me feel this way. A lot of times then people stop taking it then because of that. Instead of knowing they can speak up and do stuff. I think for our community, it's best to let them know that you have a voice, that you are a person. You are a human being like everyone else. You are a patient. You deserve the same care and compassion as everyone else. You should not walk away with any questions, with any concerns or any type of like, I want to say, like regrets either, like that you didn't ask questions. I feel like we need to know ourselves. We need to know our bodies. We need to take more of a proactive approach when it comes to healthcare and not be afraid to kind of speak up, know when something is wrong, and don't just take like no for an answer. Get a second opinion. Speak up on it. I think that if we were as a community to kind of take back the control in healthcare, then it will, I think, decrease those adverse events that happen in healthcare and mortality rates and so forth, and you'll have more compliancy and I want to say a healthier community.
Awesome. Absolutely. And so my last question to you is, the theme of the conference is Know Thyself, a call to the diaspora. What does that mean to you?
Well, knowing thyself, I want to say, is a work in action. It's not something that I would say that a lot of people, when you ask them right now, like, do you know thyself? A lot of people don't. I feel as though they have to take a moment to reflect. They have to take a moment to think about it. They're like, really, do I know myself? Do I know what I want? I think it's good to look in our roots, look where we've come from, Even in our own professional careers and our journeys and what we're doing here in the community, look at what we've come from and look how much we've grown in the direction that we're headed. And when it comes to healthcare and knowing to start off somewhere small as the nursing assistant on the floor, helping, you know, people just go to the bathroom, toilet in themselves and, you know, personal healthcare, and then to be able to be at the bedside, being a provider and caring for people. It's like, know your self-worth. Know that the sky is the limit. You could do anything that you want, long as you put your mind to it and you're determined. Nobody can stop you. I think knowing the resources that's out there will help you to be the person that you want to be. But it takes a lot to look back at where you've been and appreciate where you've been and know where you're going.
I love that. And so that was Santaya Taylor, a dual certified nurse practitioner, mentor, and community advocate here in Buffalo. She'll be a panelist at the Sankofa Conference happening February 28th, where local leaders will gather to reflect, learn, and imagine more just and responsive systems inside healthcare and beyond. And so I'm Akua Menzedu, and this is What's Next at Buffalo Toronto Public Media.